This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we're going to talk to Robert Dugoni. His new book is called The Trapped Girl, and it is coming out on January 24th, one of the first great books of the new year. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Nice to talk to you again.
You know, once again, I mean, The Trapped Girl, every one of this series is just tremendous, and, you know, I can't believe there's no more to read. I'm really depressed about that. Do you realize how depressed I am about that?
Well, it's coming. I finished the fifth, and it's already in the hopper. So we're moving right along. Yeah.
It's
called Edge of Honor, and I'm excited about it. But I got to tell you, I'm really, really excited about The Trapped Girl. The advanced reviews have been nothing short of spectacular. And you know, I don't always get that. I get positive reviews, but some review services, you know, I get sort of backhanded compliments, you know, like, well, he's not an idiot and the book's pretty good.
Really?
But I've been really excited. Publishers Weekly loved it, called it the best book yet. Kirkus loved it, and you know, they called it, you know, I think extraordinary and outstanding. And it's really exciting for me because it was, of all the Tracy Crosswhite books, it was probably the most difficult for me to write, in a lot of respects. I had multiple ideas that I was playing with and toying with, and you know, I'm not an outliner, and so you know, for me it was really trying to work through this and get it to work. And boy, I'll tell you, it really came together at the end, and it was exciting, very exciting, you know, for me, and it's been very exciting to read sort of the advanced reviews. Pre-sales have been spectacular, so, you know, I think people are, the word's getting out, and I'm just excited, David. I'm excited for the book to come out, and I'm excited for my readers to read it, so.
I can't believe you've done book five already. I'm just astounded. I didn't even know that. And I mean, that's brand news to me. I'm not surprised because you have to stay ahead of everything. But, you know, I'm still thrilled from The Trapped Girl, just finishing it and wondering and just realizing how great it really was. And whoever reads is going to feel that way. And you know, it is one of those books you just sit down and enjoy. And the more you get into it, the more you enjoy it.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It's got a lot of different layers, and that's sort of what everyone is saying is, you know, there's a number of different layers. There's a couple of main storylines. You know, there's a storyline of a, you know, 21-year-old woman in Portland, and, you know, that was fun to do. I've never, you know, never been able to do it, but the more I wrote this book, the more that character began to speak to me. And I wrote her in first person, which was really a fun experience as well, because, you know, I normally write all my books pretty much in third person, and in this book I wrote, you know, first person and third person. So it was challenging. It was, you know, and I think that's what we try to do as writers is we try to stay challenged, and we challenge ourselves, and we pick storylines that will be challenging and not easy to put together, but you know, you just keep going at it.
Well, that's when I was reading The Trapped Girl, I was thinking to myself, where is this story going? I want to know where it's going. And you have to, with your books, I always have to be patient because I know it's coming. It's just, you know, as a reader, you want instant gratification. You really do.
Right.
But the story, it has to make sense. So in order for the story to make sense, sometimes it has to be a little slow. Sometimes it has, because that's how investigations move, slowly.
Right. And that's always the, I think that's always the challenge for people like myself that are writing police procedurals is, you know, the easiest thing to do is to write a chase scene, to write a gunfire, to write a fire, you know, in an apartment, to, you know, those, the action scenes, I mean, you can fill your book with those, easily. But the point comes back to, is it realistic? Is it believable? You know, have you given the reader a chance to catch their breath? to figure out. I mean, I learned many, many years ago as a young man, and really as a boy, from my father, who loved to watch movies. And I would sit with him, and he would look at me, and he'd say, "Have you figured it out yet?" And I'd look at him and I'd go, "Dad, stop," because I knew that that was the game. You know, the game was, have you figured it out yet? Who did it? Who did it? Do you know? And, you know, a lot of the times he was right, but a lot of times he was just sort of pimping us, you know.
Well, what do you do if you figure it out in the middle of the story and you have all the story left? You know, that's kind of disappointing a little bit.
I think it can be for a lot of readers. I think it can be disappointing. You know, then what you have to do as a writer is you have to challenge them with the idea of, okay, how does this guy or woman get caught, right? How are they going to get caught? And that's the difference between a mystery and a thriller. You know, a mystery really is, you know, you're trying to figure out who did it, and hopefully you don't figure that out until you get, you know, very close to the end of the book or the movie or whatever it is. But in a thriller, you know, like a James Bond or a Jason Bourne, I mean, a lot of the times you know who the bad guy is. And the real question becomes, how is he going to get him? How is he going to win? And I kind of do a combination of those two things in my books.
So your dad he wanted to figure it out really quickly, and you were more, play it, let it play out, let me see how it ends, and maybe I'll figure it out, maybe I won't.
Right. I wanted to be surprised. You know, I wanted to have that aha moment. I wanted to sit on the couch and go, oh no, oh my God, oh my God. You know, that kind of thing. That was the fun part for me. And you know, so I tried to kind of sit back and do that. My dad was, you know, always playing sort of junior detective and trying to figure out, you know, who it was and what the combination was. To give you an example, I think that's what is the fun part of the new Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr. You know, you go to those movies and you sit and you watch, and I've done this. I've sat and I said, okay, I'm going to figure it out this time. And I will watch and I will watch and I will watch, and then you get to the end and he goes back to tell you how he figured it out, and there was a plant on the mantle and the plant was this kind of, you know what I mean? And
yep.
Mm-hmm. You just can't. You can't do it. But that's okay, because that's the fun of it. You know, that's the fun part. So,
the movie The Sixth Sense. There were so many clues in that movie, and yet you missed every one of them.
And yeah, you know, I use that movie a lot when I teach, and I laugh because, you know, there are people out there, they'll say, well, they did figure it out, but there are so many more that will say they didn't figure it out, and I'm one of those people, you know, and I sit there and I laugh because the whole movie, what's that kid saying? I see dead people. I see dead people.
It's right there in front of you.
It's right there in front of you. But I think it's because it's very Hitchcockian. You don't want to believe it. You don't want to believe that your protagonist is already dead.
Right.
The way that we're raised on books and on movies is that the protagonist doesn't die. And if the protagonist does die, it's because there's a greater good. And that movie just is, like I said, it's very Hitchcockian. It just stands it on head. It's sort of like Psycho, you know? The guy comes in and you're wed to I forget what's her name, Janet Leigh.
Janet Leigh,
you're wed to her in this movie, and she dies in like the first half an hour.
And then
you're like, well, now what the hell do I do?
Yeah, who's left, you know? It's like, and you're right. But why do I like Tracy Crosswhite so much? I mean, the series is just phenomenal. Everyone I read, I love. And I always think when I start your book, I think, please don't let this be a book that's not going to surprise me. Please don't let that happen. Don't let that ever happen. And it hasn't happened. And in all four books, I've been surprised with every one. And every one I've thoroughly enjoyed. And I'm not just saying that. I really have. And, you know, this is the best thing you've ever, the best stuff you've ever done, as far as I'm concerned. And
yeah, you know, I think that's my job. I mean, you know, a lot of people get up and go to work at a factory, or they get up and go to work at a car dealership, or whatever they do, and they have a job to do. And I have a job to do, and my job is to write the best book that I can that, you know, keeps people interested, that keeps people, moves their emotions, that makes them want to sit down at night and read it. You know, the nicest compliments I get are from people that will say to me, you know, I finished your book at 4 o'clock this morning. I couldn't put it down, because that's my job. And, you know, I try my best. I don't think any author, if they're honest, can say you know, that every book they write is their best book. I mean, you know, sometimes you write the best book that you can at the time that you're writing it.
Exactly.
But I definitely think it's our job to, you know, to try to put something out there that people enjoy and that people will like and that people will respond to.
But it has to have a good beginning, middle, and ending. It's got to have all those three things or it's not going to be worth reading, to me anyway. I don't know how anybody else feels, but I mean, you can pick up a book and just enjoy the way it's written, and maybe the plot's not good, maybe the characters aren't memorable, but that's not going to help me. That's not going to do anything for me. I can appreciate good writing, but if I don't have a good plot, I don't have good characters, and I don't have a good surprise at the end, I'm going to be probably going to be disappointed.
Yeah, no, and I don't blame readers for that. I mean, I don't. I mean, they pick a book up to be entertained. They pick a book up to be surprised. You know, whatever the reason they're picking the book up, you know, that's what my job is. And, you know, I do try hard. You know, I there are times when...
But, and it's got to be really hard. It's got to be very difficult to come up, and every book you've got to do this. It's not like you can say, well, this book I'll lay back on my haunches and just write anything. You can't do that.
No, you can't.
Because then you can lose thousands of readers if you do that.
Right, and readers know it. You know, sophisticated readers, they know it, and they know what you're doing.
When you're calling it in, when it's just a book that doesn't mean anything or doesn't resonate with you, and
they get discouraged. But you know, David, I will say this: as important as it is for a reader, from my perspective, to be challenged to try to figure out the ending, to be challenged to, you know, try to figure out who did it or how they did it or why they did it. I do also believe that readers, to a large extent, like to be moved. They like to have their emotions not toyed with, but at least played with. You know, they like to cry. They like to laugh out loud. You know, for a lot of people, and I've learned this more and more over the years, for so many people, books are a refuge. And I will get emails all the time from people that will say to me, you know, I have cancer, I'm going through chemotherapy treatment, and your books were one of the things that, you know, allowed me to take my mind off of the things going on in my life. And when you get emails like that, you can't help but be moved, because you can't help but think, my God, you know, something that I wrote, something that I did, reached somebody in Massachusetts who's suffering so greatly. And I never try to forget that's really
what
books and movies are about, is getting people to go away for a few hours, to forget their problems, to forget what is going on in their life, and just to be moved and to be entertained.
I remember one New Year's I was sick, and I read a book by, I don't know how you say his name, Michael Robotham. I think he's an Australian writer. He wrote a book called Say You're Sorry, an absolutely fantastic novel. And the reason I got better from being sick is reading that book. I don't know what it is. Somehow that book helped me get better. I couldn't even explain to you how it happened, but I know it happened. Because I know that when I was reading it, even though I was sick and I was not feeling well at all, that book just catapulted me into some kind of a wonderful place where I could just enjoy the book and forget I was sick. Yeah, I still felt the pain. I still felt, you know, but I still could enjoy the book. And you know how when you're sick, you can't always enjoy a book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, absolutely. And you know, I do think that books can be a refuge for so many people. And that's really what I've come to learn with the success is that, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are hurting. There are a lot of people out there that are alone, and there are a lot of people that take great comfort in a book. And so I try to never mail it in. I always try to give it my best. Is it always going to be the best? No, but it's going to be the best that I can do at that time. And sometimes they'll move some people, and they won't move other people, and that's just the nature of art.
Well, but the problem with your books, the problem with your books, Robert, is that we get in the middle of them, and we don't want the books to end because we know there's nothing afterwards. I mean, I can't read any more Tracy Crossway books, and that really upsets me. You have no idea how much that upsets me.
Wait till September, then no one's coming.
I don't know if I can wait that long. That's the horrible part. I mean, when you enjoy a series and you suddenly realize, wait, this is going to be it. I have nothing after this to read, and I have no idea where to turn. Because you can't always pick up a book and say, I know this one's going to be good, because a lot of times it may not be.
Right.
So when I was reading The Trap Girl, I realized I don't have anything else by him after this. It's just terrible. It's just, and I physically got depressed. I mean, I was, like, really upset about this. And, you know, and people out there are thinking, he's crazy. There's plenty of books out there. Surely you can find another good one. But it isn't that easy. It's not that easy. I mean, your book is as good, if not better, than Michael Connelly's. And I his new one. And to me, that's the way I felt.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. He's obviously someone that I respect and admire, and I've always looked up to. He's a terrific writer. So, I mean, to be put in the same sentence with him is flattering.
But you're better with multiple characters than I think he is. He's more about Harry and what Harry goes through. We see it all through Harry's eyes. So I think that kind of, to me, while I did enjoy the books, and I do enjoy the Harry books, it's kind of limiting in a way too, also.
Wow.
But yeah, that's just how I feel.
I enjoy his books. I really do. I think he's one of those people out there that he's one of the guys that when a book comes out, I will get it because he's, you know, I know I'm going to get a good read.
But you are so good at what you do. I mean, you're just so, and I don't know how you do it. I really don't know how. I don't know how you sit down with a blank page and suddenly create this story that makes such wonderful sense and is so enjoyable to read. I don't know how you do that. How do you do that?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I've had this conversation a couple of times, and I'll be perfectly honest with you. I know this sounds woo-woo. I know it does, but I'm not exactly sure. I'm not a terrific technician. You know, I'm not the kind of person that plot something out and tries to find all the, you know, really kind of cool clues and cool evidence ahead of time. I know writers that do that. And there are times, David, where I will actually go back and I will read something that I have written and I won't recognize that I wrote it. It won't seem familiar to me.
That's gotta be freaky.
It is a little bit. It is a little bit, to be honest with you. But it's kind of the nature of who I am. And I think that's part of what being a writer is accepting who you are, and, you know, all your strengths and all your faults and saying to yourself, yeah, I have low levels of anxiety or I have this or I have that. But that's part of what makes me a good writer. I mean, that's part of what compels me to move forward to.
But how do you know that? How do you know that in book 7 and book 8 you're not going to get to the point where you can't write as well as you're writing now? How do you know that?
I don't.
Doesn't that scare you to death?
You know, I guess it could if you dwelled on it. but I don't dwell on it. I've put out, you know, 13 books now, I think, and I just I have a strong faith. And I have a strong belief that this is what I was supposed to do, and I'm going to do it. And does that mean that every day is going to be a great day? No. Does that mean I'm going to have a bad day? Yeah. But everybody has bad days. I mean, everybody. I don't care what they do for a living. They get up and they have a bad day. They have work doesn't go well. Something in their personal life doesn't go well. Their kids are hurting. You know what? Everybody has those days, and what I've come to learn over the years is to just accept the fact that I didn't have a good day. This is not a good day. Well, all right, it's not a good day. But that doesn't mean tomorrow has to be a bad day.
I guess it's just that some writers have a lot more to say than others. I mean, Harper Lee, she wrote what, 2 books, and that's all she had to say. That's all she wanted to say. I guess.
Right.
I mean, had they pressed her into writing more books, she probably still wouldn't have done it.
But, you know. I doubt that she. I doubt that she would have.
But you can't. You can't make a writer write a good book. You just have to let them create and see what comes of it, and hope that something good comes of it. I mean,
the other thing.
Yeah. No,
go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I think the other thing is, you know, I was raised from, you know, parents who were you know. Children that came through the Depression and all those years and everything. And, you know, the other thing that I always keep in mind is, you know, you have to work for a living. And this is what I do. This is what I do.
But you love doing it.
My work.
You absolutely love doing it.
And that's a blessing. And I do not discount that blessing ever.
But do you ever get up in the morning and say, I don't want to write today. I just don't want to write today.
No.
That never happens?
I get up every morning, and I am absolutely thrilled to go to my office. I mean, there are days after a weekend or a long weekend where I've taken the weekend off and just spent time with my family because I can do that now. I'm not working two jobs. I'm not, you know, and so Monday morning we'll roll around and I cannot wait to get into the office. I can't wait to get in and to get started doing, you know, whatever I'm doing.
And but you feel that way every day?
Every day I write, pretty much, yeah.
That's amazing. Because I've had many writers tell me that it's work, it's too much, it's work to them. It's really, really feels like work, and they are not always motivated to do it.
No, it's work to me in a sense that I take seriously that this is what I do for a living. And you know, everybody has to get up and you go to work, and this is what you do. But it's not work for me in the sense that, oh God, I gotta go in and write another book. No, it's never been like that for me. I love what I do, and I know that what I do is, the fact that I can do it is a blessing. The fact that I love what I do is a blessing, because I know there are so many people out there that don't get to do what they love to do, or don't get to do, you know, what they want to do, how they want to do it. And you know, I don't take it for granted. I never ever take it for granted that I'm truly very, very blessed.
Well, what did that feel like? You talk in your YouTube interviews, you talk about that time in school where you had to read your story out loud in front of, was it a gymnasium or something?
It was in front of a class, seventh grade.
What was that like to have to read your story in front of all those people? Weren't you a nervous wreck?
No, I don't remember being a nervous wreck. I really don't.
I would have been.
In fact, I remember that moment when it kind of hit me. I remember it very, very clearly. I mean, I even still remember parts of the speech. You know, I don't know where it is now, but
you weren't nervous at all?
The speech. No, I remember just sitting there and just getting this feeling like, wow, this is really cool.
Are you fearless? I mean,
really cool.
Is there nothing you're afraid of?
Oh God, no. God, no, I told you off the air, you know, I suffer with some anxiety, you know, I have low levels of anxiety, and so there are certain things I have to do in my life, you know, to deal with that. Everybody has something, and everybody's afraid of something. I'm afraid of dying, and I have a strong faith, but I'm afraid of dying. You know, I'm afraid of something happening to my kids. I mean, all the things that people worry about. You know, I worry about, but I, you know, everybody has something.
And that's a point when you're reading a book. Sometimes those fears are realized in the book. Something will happen in the book, and it'll trigger something. Oh my God, that's my worst fear. So you
right.
have this trigger mechanism that just goes off, and you think, oh my God, how is this going to play out? I mean, what if it was me? What if I was living this? How would I deal with it?
Right, and that's, I think that's the job of a writer. The job of a writer is to tap into those little phobias and fears that we all have, and to try to, you know, make your character come to life by having those same things. You know, I don't write superheroes. I've never written superheroes. My characters tend to be people that have the same limitations and flaws, or whatever you want to call them, that everybody else has. But they just tend to rise to the moment. And that's what makes a person a hero is, you know, it's not that person who's, you know, super strong or anything like that. It's that person that confronts the thing that they're most afraid of and they deal with it.
But it's funny because you hear about writers that are very introverted. You know, they don't want to be out in the public. They don't want to meet their public necessarily. But you're not, you don't seem to be like that. You seem to enjoy talking in front of people. You seem to enjoy when you have a chance to express yourself in front of people. And that's a wonderful thing. So you have it both ways. You love to write and you love people. And, you know, and a lot of writers are not like that.
No, I recognize that. And I know there are some writers that are like that. But I respect that too. Because again, that goes back to who they are. That goes back to their personality. It's not always easy for me to get up in front of a group of people. There are moments when, you know, you do have those fears or whatever you want to call them.
Well, how do you feel when you go to a conference and you have all these authors that are like best-selling authors? and they've been around for years and years. Do you feel intimidated? Like you're not, I mean, how do you feel?
No, I'm never intimidated. You know, they're just people. You know, that's what I say, is that they're just people. I've never been intimidated by anybody that I've met. I don't think I ever would be. I could meet the President of the United States. I could meet, you know, great athletes. And, you know, it's just, they have a skill that God gave them, and they're using it to make a living. And it, you know, so if you have a great athlete, that great athlete is no different than a great
writer. You're not even nervous to go up and talk to them?
No. I'm really not. No, I mean, you know, again, there are probably, I tell people this, there are three people in life whose autograph I would have asked for. Jimmy Stewart, because he gave me so much enjoyment watching It's a Wonderful Life and other movies. Muhammad Ali, because of just, you know, who he was overall as a person. And the last one will make people laugh. It was Jack Klugman. Jack Klugman, because, you know, there was a time in my life when watching The Odd Couple was really, really therapeutic for me. And he just brought me hours and hours of joy watching The Odd Couple. Those are probably the only three people in life who I'd say, you know, gee, I'd go up and I'd get that person's autograph. Other than that, you know, everyone's a human being. Everyone's a person. Everyone, you know, what they do for a living is just what they do for a living. It doesn't necessarily make them special.
I'm just amazed at the three people you mentioned. I would never have guessed any of those in a million years. I mean,
yeah, most people wouldn't.
Not that I know enough about you that I would be able to hazard a guess, but I mean, one of mine would be Stephen King. There's no doubt in my mind. He's the one.
Oh yeah.
He's the one that I would most want to meet. If I could meet anybody today, that would be the first person I would. Just because
he was
so much a part of my childhood, so much a part of my adulthood, you know, reading his books. I feel like he was just almost my father, almost, just because he was speaking to me so much and with all these books that he was. But a lot of people would say, well, he's probably really creepy and probably really weird. And maybe he is, but it still doesn't change how I feel.
Well, and it doesn't change that he has a talent. He has a gift, and he uses that gift. And if you read his, you know, his history, it wasn't always easy for him, but he stayed with it, and he just pushed and pushed. And, you know, that talent, that gift came forward, and he's a great writer, and he hasn't had an easy life. You know, the car accident and the injuries in the car accident, you know, severely hurt him. He suffered from that. He suffered from, I think, alcohol or drug addiction as a result of the injury he was in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here's another little dirty secret. I read The Green Mile every single day that I'm writing. Every day that I'm writing, I start my day off by going into my office with a cup of tea, closing the door, and reading The Green Mile. And I have probably read that book 50 times, but I just start reading it. Because to me, the excellence in that book is something that I will probably never be able to achieve, but I can certainly aspire.
Why do you feel that way? I mean, you're a terrific storyteller, and do you know that you are?
I feel like I'm reaching a point, a peak, where enough people have said to me how much they enjoy my books that I do accept it. I do accept the fact that I do well.
But it isn't an ego thing. You're not an ego. Don't have an ego. It doesn't even come across that you do. I mean, you have two kids, right?
I have two kids, yeah.
And just from looking at your Facebook posts, I can see you're a great father. I mean, just from the fact you spend time with them, obviously. I think it's just a wonderful thing. I mean, I would give anything if my father had spent more time with me, like you do with your kids.
That's part of my job, and that's kind of what I'm going back to, is everybody has things in life that they do and that they're good at. You know, I try to be a good husband. I'm not always. I mean, you know, I'm human. I try to be a good father. I'm not always. But that's part of your job. You
the
know?
Fact that you admit that is an amazing thing. A lot of people wouldn't even admit that. They just say, well, I'm a pretty good father, and they'd leave it at that. You know, but we get to see all, watching your interviews and listening to you even now, I mean, we hear your vulnerabilities. They're there, and you're not afraid to admit them. You're not afraid
I'm
to
not
admit,
afraid.
Well, maybe I'm not the best father, and maybe I don't have enough time, or maybe I'm not the best storyteller, but you are a good storyteller. I mean, you're just amazing. Every book that I read of yours is just amazes me, and that's one of the reasons we're talking, because this book just moved me. It did something to me as far as, and like I said, after I was done, it was like, wow, what am I going to read now? You know, what am I going to do? And I literally would think, I don't know if you've ever felt that feeling, but.
Oh, I have. There have been books that I have put down. You know, there's been Stephen King books that I've put down, and I've thought, God, I wish he'd write a sequel. You know, I wish I could find out more what's going on and what happened. I remember when I read Lonesome Dove. You know, I was 30 years old, and it was a point in my life where I was, you know, I was single and had come out of a relationship that, you know, we all think it was supposed to be the relationship, and I read Lonesome Dove, and you get to the point at the end, and Captain Call is all alone. They're all gone. Gus is gone. Pee-wee's gone. They're all gone, and he's alone. And I remember crying. I'm in my room. I remember finishing that book, and I remember crying.
And how does a writer do that? How does a writer bring these characters to life? I mean, you do it so well with Tracy and her cohorts, and you even throw in a lot of humor, which is hard to do.
I think it goes back to allowing them to be human, not being afraid of what our frailties are, what our weaknesses are, not even weaknesses, but our limitations, and allowing your characters to have those. You know, allowing your characters to be nervous, allowing your characters to be fearful, allowing your characters to be anxious, allowing your characters to, you know, to not agree with something that's going on. I mean, I think that's what life really is about, is, you know, like I said before, everybody out there has something. You know, nobody out there is perfect, and I think that what I try to do is I try to give them characters who aren't perfect.
And what I like about Dan is Tracy's boyfriend at the beginning of the book anyway. But and what I like about Dan is Dan just tells it like it is. He doesn't hold back from her. He just, if he thinks she's being an idiot, he'll tell her that.
Right.
So he kind of balances out the relationship, even though.
Right.
You know, some women would say, well, how dare you? How dare you question the way I am? But he does question the way she is.
Yeah, and I think we all need that. You know, I think we all need that. You know, I have a wife. She's fabulous. I was blessed to have, you know, this terrific person come into my life and be a part of my life. But my wife is not impressed by me. You know what I mean?
Really?
I mean, no, of course not. She loves me. There's no doubt in my mind that she loves me and she, you know.
You mean she's not impressed by your writing?
No, she's not impressed by me. She loves my writing. She just read The Seventh Canon. She's reading The Trap Girl now. And she thought The Seventh Canon, which came out last September, was the best thing I've ever written. And she told me that. But in the next sentence, she said, can you empty the dishwasher?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Well, in that way, maybe not impressed. But, you know, But I think, but she is impressed by your writing. That's what I was glad to hear you.
Oh, she loves my writing.
If you were going to tell me that your wife hated your writing, I was going to be really horrified.
No. And I think kids have a way of humbling us, you know? I go to my kids' sporting events and I watch them and they play as hard as they can and sometimes they have good days and sometimes they have bad days. And, you know, your job as a father is to let them know that if they did their best, that's okay. You're gonna have good days. You're gonna have bad days. Don't worry about it. There are other things in life that are more important. You know, my daughter had a basketball game last night. She played very well. You know, it wasn't her best game ever, but she played very well. We came home and decorated the Christmas tree.
Exactly.
And that's what she'll remember about that night. She'll remember decorating the Christmas tree with Dad. You know, we had Christmas carols going, and, you know, we made an evening of it. We put up Christmas ornaments from 1996 and 98 and from San Francisco and from New York. And
well, something tells me, right, exactly. Something tells me you're not the kind of dad that if you were in the middle of writing and your one of your kids knocked on the door and said, I need to talk to you, you wouldn't stop what you were doing and talk to your children.
No, my wife and my kids come first. And I just, you know, that was learned behavior. That was my dad. You know, again, you know, we all recognize this, right? Is that, you know, someday we're going to have to look back on our lives and what do we remember the most about our lives? And there's that famous quote, I don't know who said it, but they said, I never looked back on my life and said, gee, I wish I had worked more.
Right.
And I think that's very, very true. I think that the thing that we do is we look back on our life, on the moments, with the people that we love, and doing the things that we love to do with the people we love. And, you know, when that day comes for me, I hope I look back on my life and say to myself, wow, I raised a terrific young man. My wife and I raised a terrific daughter, and I have, you know, have these great grandkids that are running around the house. That's what I'll remember.
Right. But see, I remember my dad as being very unapproachable. You're very approachable. Even just talking to you, I can tell that you are. And that's so important for kids. I mean, when you have children, they have to be able to come to you anytime they need you. And it doesn't matter what situation you're in. You still have to be able to help them out and at least listen to them. Maybe you can't solve all their problems, but you have to be able to at least listen.
And absolutely.
My dad, in his age, he didn't do that kind of stuff. He was always the yelling type, the how could you do that kind of type, making you feel bad. When the last thing you want to do is make your children feel bad. You wanted them to know that you're there for them.
Well, again, everybody's got their limitations and so I try to do the best that I can do. And the interesting thing, David, is you never know what's going to come back and show up in a book. You know, I'll be writing a book and suddenly something will come to me and it'll be something that I dealt with one of my kids or that my wife and I dealt with, or we were on, vacation and it came up and I sit there and I stare at the page and I say, oh my God, wow. Maybe that's why that happened.
Does your wife ever say, well, why'd you put that in the book? I know what you were referring to with that. Does she ever do that to you?
No. When I wrote The Seventh Canon, I had many of my brothers and sisters calling me and saying, oh my God, I picked up on the cream puff, which is my mom's specialty at Christmas. I picked up on this, I picked up on that. Well, that's not coincidental. I put a lot of people that I loved and admired in The Seventh Canon. They were people obviously that my brothers and sisters knew. But again, that's what I mean is sometimes, writing it is just about taking those things in life that we experience and putting them down on paper.
So the beginning of this book, they find a body in a crab pot. That's the beginning of this story, this wonderful, wonderful story, which I, believe me, had no idea where it was going until it just went, and then I was shocked. And, there's all kinds of surprises in this book, which is not giving anything away, but because all your books are surprises. All your books are full of surprises. I assume the fifth one's going to be the same, full of surprises.
I'm trying.
Did you actually do any research for this? Did you actually go and see what a crab pot looked like?
Oh yeah.
It looks. On the front of the book, it almost looks like a hockey net almost.
No, there are different kinds of crab pots. There are, the smaller crab pots that people just use to go out crabbing off the shore, and then there are commercial crab pots. And obviously, this one had to be a little bit bigger because of there's a body in it. If you watch The Deadliest Catch, those are commercial crab pots. There was a lot of research in this. I tend to get in trouble when I think I know something and then I don't research it. I had a situation in The Trapped Girl where my wife, was reading the book and she said to me, did you know that you called Bremerton an island? It's not an island. I didn't know. And so, I had to call my editor up and say, hey, I made a mistake. But see, the problem there is I thought I knew. And so I didn't research it. And so I always try to find somebody who knows and just, confirm with them, and go through it. That's kind of what I'm in the process of the new book. That's in the process of what I'm doing now is I'm waiting for confirmation, from people who I've relied upon and interviewed and talked to look at certain chapters for me and tell me whether I got them right or not. And if I got them wrong, how to fix them.
Exactly. And you'll have to be able to take that criticism, too. And it's meant, you know, because it's meant in a helpful way, not in a, well, we're just going to tear you apart kind of way, you know. And I'm sure you have readers that do that, that will write to you and say, well, this, and then just list all the different things they found wrong with books or whatever. But I don't ever find anything wrong with them. But I can imagine that somebody's found something somewhere, because all the little, it's hard to get all the little details right.
It's very hard. It's very hard. I mean, it's 400 pages, and I've never been a police officer, you know. So it's very hard, and that's why I'm blessed. I rely on the expertise of a lot.
So Tracy's not based on anybody in a real police department.
No.
And have you ever looked? Have you ever been done any research in a police department to see, to get an idea of what it's like?
Oh yeah, no, I've been in the Seattle homicide or violent crime section. I've been in their building and in their department and in their cubicles many times. And I've talked to several female homicide detectives. But at the time I started writing these books, there was really only one. There was two. The first one that started who helped me was a woman named Dana Duffy, who has since kind of moved into doing other things. And then the person who's really helped me tremendously is a detective in the Seattle homicide, and her husband is also a detective. He's a King County sheriff. And so I spent a lot of time there. And in fact, some of the characters, you know, that I pull, you know, are very, very loosely based upon, you know, some of the people that I met and some of the humor that they exhibit and use. I mean, you know, you can only imagine, right? I mean, everybody can imagine. It's an extremely difficult job on so many levels. I mean, I think one of the hardest parts of that job, which I try to bring through Tracy, is how do you leave it at work? You know, how do you find
she doesn't leave it at work?
It must be so difficult. You know, you find a woman's body in a crap pot and you're supposed to go home and you know, eat a hamburger.
Right.
And it must be incredibly difficult. And that's why I have tremendous respect for law enforcement, because they have such an extremely difficult job. And are there bad apples out there? Sure. There are bad apples everywhere.
Well, you wonder how Tracy even functions with her sister being dead. You know, it's like that's a major traumatic thing.
Yeah.
How do you function day to day, perform a, and I'm sure it's like 50, 60 hours a week for some of these people. How do you function that much when you're so upset? And maybe that's why you do it. I mean, to get away from those, thinking about it too much. Maybe concentrating on something else helps you get through that. I don't know.
I think that's very true, and I think there are a lot of people out there in similar situations. You do the best you can, and you try to think of something else.
That's the most traumatic thing. To lose somebody that close to you, somebody you were that close to, has got to affect you for the rest of your life. It doesn't ever go away. It's probably going to be mentioned in every book you write in this series.
I think it has to be, like, for the reason you said. You know, it defines who she is. It defines what she does, and it defines, you know, why things are important to her that might not be important to other people. And I think, you know, I think all, again, some of us are blessed to, you know, to have had, you know, wonderful parents and wonderful lives and all that kind of thing, but not everybody has. And I think that's what people identify with, is that this is not a perfect human being. You know, Tracy Crosswhite is not a perfect human being in a lot of respects.
Well, she were. The stories would be boring, wouldn't they?
I think life would be boring. You know?
Yeah.
We're not perfect. You know, we make mistakes, and we have to own up to those mistakes sometimes.
Well, it seems like you had really good parents, and you seem like you're a good parent. So, I mean, you're doing a lot of things right. You've had a lot of good things happen in your past. So you must have a lot of good memories of your childhood.
I'm fabulous. I'm one of 10 kids. I mean, I could have been raised in 10.
Oh my God.
I could have been raised in a better household. Christmas was always the most special time of year for all of us, for me. And I was extremely blessed, and I recognize that. But it wasn't perfect. You know, nobody's life is, and I think that's part of the challenge for all of us in life is to recognize and accept that, you know, it's not perfect, but it's never going to be perfect. And so you make it as perfect as you can make it, and not try to judge other people by, you know, how they live their life or what they choose to do.
We seem to be going that way at the moment. And life in general seems to be. I mean, with the internet, there's so much judgmental stuff out there now, and people just screaming at each other and saying things about each other that shouldn't be said. It shouldn't be, you know, and so much on the internet that probably shouldn't even be on the internet. And it's a scary time right now.
I would agree with you. Yeah.
I mean, and what do you? I love seeing people's posts. I love hearing what they have to say, but, you know, sometimes they go a little too far with it. And you got to remember that stuff just hangs around. It's like you go on and then there it is again. And it's like, you know, you can't get it out of your head. So was the Trap Girl harder to write than the one after? What did you say number five was called?
Number five, is called Edge of Honor. The Trap Girl is the most difficult book that I've written in the Tracy Crosswhite series.
Why would it be the most difficult?
Because I had a concept in mind that I was going to have a crime take place up on Mount Rainier, and Tracy was going to get involved and yada yada. And I did a ton of research and I found out that it wouldn't work. It couldn't work. It couldn't happen.
Huh.
And so I had to kind of make changes to it and adjustments to it. And I had this whole backstory of this, you know, young girl down in Portland, Oregon, who, you know, gets married, and it was coming to me, and I was writing it, and I knew I liked it, I knew I liked her, I knew all those things, but I didn't really know yet how it was going to fit into the story, and so there was just a lot of moments of uncertainty and angst, and I just had to trust my instincts to go forward. That there was a reason, you know, why I was writing what I was writing, and it was going to become clear to me. And then when it did become clear to me, it was like, okay, I can get this to work. And I went back and began to sort of, you know, rework things and redo things.
It sounds agonizing.
But it was,
time.
You know, probably, you know, no more agonizing than the guy that's on some, you know, manufacturing process line, you know, for 8 hours a day. It's life. It's work. It's what we do. If it was easy, everyone would do it, right? And so, you know, it's not always easy, but I try to find the joy in it. And I love to do it. It's what I love to do.
Well, when you got to that point where you realized it couldn't work, did you lay awake at night worrying about what you were going to do? I mean, was it that agonizing?
There are times when it can be, sure. Sure, but one of the things that's the beauty of going to sleep is that your subconscious works, and sometimes your subconscious will figure out the plot for you. I think sometimes what it comes down to is trusting the process. You know, trusting the process and trusting the fact that you've done this before, you've had difficulties before. But trusting the process and saying to yourself, okay, you know what? This is not easy. It's not coming to me. I exercise a lot. And I think the exercise helps a lot. Helps to get my mind working and my mind going and to think about different things. But, you know, it's a job and it's a great job, but you know, sometimes, like I said, you have good days and sometimes you have bad.
What happens?
You just have to accept it.
Exactly. What happens when you're having a great day and you're writing real, real well and the phone rings and something pulls you away from what you were doing? Is it easy for you to go back and still have that same rhythm, or do you have to, is it difficult to get back into it again?
Yeah, no, not always. And sometimes the phone doesn't even have to ring. Sometimes it just goes away. And sometimes it goes away for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you go into the office and you can't even write a grocery list if somebody dictated it to you. But, you know, like that's what I mean by accepting the fact that, okay, today's not going to be a good day. So what can I do? Well, you know, you persevere, you push through. Yeah, what I started to do, a friend of mine does this, and, you know, I did it for the first time in this book that I just wrote, is I knew there were certain scenes that were going to come into play in the book, and so I'd write those scenes because I knew they were going to be there. So on those days, I would write those scenes, or maybe I'll stop and I'll do research on something, or, you know, there's a lot of different things that you can do. But, you know, again, I think it's just accepting the fact that it's not going to be perfect, and you're not always going to have a great day.
When did you realize you would really be able to write books? I mean, you wrote The Jury Master. Did you realize after you wrote The Jury Master that you were going to have a long career after that, or was it like
No, I've never thought necessarily I was going to have a long career. I mean, there's always been moments of self doubt and worry, you know,
which you still had today.
There's been many moments. You know, one of the reasons I started writing Tracy Crosswhite books is because the David Sloan series kind of ended. And I wasn't getting the support from, you know, the publisher at the time. You know, I had to kind of reinvent myself and recreate myself. And that was very scary, you know, when you have kids and you're trying to put them through school and college and expenses and all those things. It was very scary. But again, I think, you know, what we come to realize is that this is what I do. I'm a writer, and I'm just going to have to persevere. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there in this business that are struggling. They're having difficult times. They've written 10 books, and they're not where they want to be, and they're not where they thought they would be. And so, you know, I mean, we all struggle with that.
And then Paula Hawkins comes along and writes The Girl on the Train and sells 6 million copies, you know. Go figure.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
you can never figure where life is going. You know, it's like all of a sudden, bam, everybody's reading that book.
Right.
And for a good reason. It is a good book. I really enjoyed it. But, you know, you just never know. I mean, now she's got the magic touch with just book one. But, you know, and already book two's coming out next year, I see. But,
yeah.
You know, you don't always know that's going to happen. Have you sold 6 million of any of your books? I don't know.
Yeah, no. I don't know if a lot of people have.
But that, I mean, it's such a staggering amount. Well, why, what is in that book that got so many people reading it? I mean, that's what you ask yourself. What is that magic touch that she has that made people read that book? And as opposed to 50 million other books she could have been reading, these people
right.
could have been reading.
And you know, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be writing that book. But I think that's the beauty of art is there is no answer to that question. There is no answer to what moves people.
Well, you write series and you write standalone. Is one more fun to write than the other, or are they equally as good?
No, I think every book, you know, every book I've written, I've enjoyed writing. You know, and I think that's the goal for any writer is to whether it's a standalone or whether it's a series, it's writing a book that you want to write, that you enjoy writing, you know, you get something out of it.
Well, I guess with a standalone, starting out fresh with new characters and something you've never done before can be very exciting. It sounds like it would be exciting to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, when I started out this business, I thought I was writing standalones.
Whereas with Tracy, you have to ask yourself, now, what did she do before? What I have to remember every book before this, just in case something comes up and I get it wrong, you know? That's hard.
Right. Well, I have a cheat sheet, and that helps, you know? What kind of car she drives, what kind of this, what kind of that, all those things. And so, yeah, but, you know, you do have a different kind of challenge, and that challenge is remembering what you wrote in the prior book.
Exactly.
And then where do you go from there? Because, you know, I don't write James Bond where, you know, he's the same guy starting over, you know, every single time. You know, Tracy changes. You know, she's changed already dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I have to always kind of remember that.
Do you have a certain number of books that are going to be in this series? I mean, would you like to see 30 in this series?
I'd love to see 30.
Can you imagine doing 30 books in this series?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if people like them, sure.
I mean, can you see that far ahead, that you could really have that many stories? It wouldn't be a problem?
No, I mean, I can't say like J.K. Rowling, you know, that I can see seven books ahead.
Exactly.
But what I can say is, you know, I can see, you know, I can see that she's going to have these pivotal moments in her life, you know?
And you don't even know all there is to know about Tracy right now.
No, I mean, is she going to marry Dan or not, you know? I don't know. Got to write that. Is she going to have kids? I don't know. Got to write that.
Right.
You know, are her kids then going to get in trouble? I don't know. But, I mean, life is a journey.
Well, the question is, how far do you go, too? Your books are not what I would call really graphic books. They never really are. I mean, I just finished reading an author named Cody McFadden. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. One of the most graphic writers there is out there. And after I read his books, I have to sit and think about them for days and just think, what did I just read and how did I get through it and how did I not, how was I, I was affected by it, but how much was I really affected by it? And I don't think, with your books, it's much more of an enjoyment thing. When I'm done, I've enjoyed it and I can move on. I still think about it, but it doesn't bother me to the extent of, you know, that was really graphic. How do I take all that in, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think there's definitely a market for that and there's people that do it well. I'm just not that guy. It's not what I want to write. It's not how I write. And so, it's just a different market, but it's not something that I,
like Thomas Harris, you know, you read Thomas Harris books and you really almost feel like taking a shower after you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there are people out there that will tell you, you know, that they love his books and they love those kind of books. And it's like the people that, you know, will go to a movie to have the Jesus scared out of them. I mean, that's why they go. They go to the movie because they know that the movie's going to scare the hell out of them.
Right.
And I'm the opposite, you know. I'm just not that guy. I'm not the guy that wants to be scared to death, you know. And so I think it's just kind of, you know, what you want to do and what you want to write. And some people are very good at it. I mean, there's Stephen King books out there that'll scare the crap out of you.
Exactly.
Right? But,
well, there must be some interest with Amazon to turn these Tracy Crosswhites into a series. Has there been any interest?
Well, what do you mean? I don't follow you.
I mean, a TV series. Either TV or downloading or whatever.
I can't really talk about it yet, but that's well in the works. And
right.
it's not an Amazon thing. It's just a, you know, I have an agent in LA that's well on its way.
Really?
But and you know, next time you and I talk, I might be able to say it's all done and stuff. But right now, we're still kind of.
Well, that's really exciting.
It's exciting for me for a lot of reasons, you know, just to see how somebody else, you know, the medium they use and how they use it, and I think it'd be really exciting. I mean, there's obviously, you know, it's a long process, I guess, is what I'm learning. And you just, you got to go through all the different.
I'm picturing who would be a good Tracy.
Yeah, I have a lot of people that email me and give me ideas on that. You know, I don't know what the answer is.
I would, my first,
hopefully we'll see.
Without thinking too much, one of my first choices would be Emily Blunt.
Yeah, that would be good.
I like her. I like her the way she's got that vulnerable side to her. She's got that, as we saw in The Devil Wore Prada, she's just fantastic in that movie. Just thinking about her in that movie, I just, you know, she's got all this, she's a good actress, she's good with emotions, and that's what you need. That's what you kind of need with I don't know about the strong side of her. I don't know. Tracy's a very strong character.
Yeah.
I picture almost like a masculine character. Does she have a masculine side to her?
I think a lot of people have a masculine side to them and a feminine side to them. And you know, the question is whether or not they're willing to acknowledge that or to go there. So.
But that would be my first choice. And I don't even know if it would work. But that's the one that And I'm sure there's plenty of other actresses out there that would,
sure,
they yeah. would be fit the bill. But that's exciting to hear. That's really exciting.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the next time we talk, I'll have more information for you, and we'll.
Now, are you working on book six now?
I'm probably going to write a sequel to the Seventh Canon, and that's sort of what I'm doing now. I'm meeting with a lot of experts on the fifth Tracy book, but I'm looking at and thinking about writing a sequel to the Seventh Canon.
Well, you said the fifth one's done already. The fifth Tracy is already finished.
Correct.
Right, but there is going to be a sixth one.
Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Good. Don't tell me there. Aren't, don't tell me five's going to be it. I'll just go crazy if that's true.
No, there'll be more.
Oh, good. Thank God for that. Don't scare me with that, you know, I think. Because that's, I guess as readers, we think to ourselves, well, if he's working on something else, maybe he's never going back to that series again. And it's kind of scary for readers.
Yeah, no, I think at times it can be. And right now, the plan is to keep going forward, so.
I think as a writer, you forget how the readers get so emotionally involved with these books that it's part of their life. I mean, but it becomes a real part of their lives. It's not just I read it and I'm done. Go on to the next one. They take it in, and they these characters seem very real to them.
That's the hope, right?
Exactly.
You know, that's the hope.
Well, it certainly comes through in The Trap Girl and all this whole series. So, you know, and I still can see the rope on the first one. The first book had that rope on the cover, and I thought to myself, oh my God, not another serial killer book. That was my first thought about the book, and little did I know what I was going to get into. It was something completely
right.
different. You know, it was something that I was going to enjoy thoroughly. So that's nice. And we sometimes do judge books by their cover. You know, you look at a cover and you think, oh my God, that looks horrible. Before you know it, you know, maybe you don't want to read it. But, you know,
right.
I'm so glad I did. Well, it's been great to talk to you. I can't believe we've been talking for an hour. God, the hour just goes flying by. It's so enjoyable. And
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too. I really have.
And it's every time we talk, it's enjoyable. The book, again, is called The Trap Girl. It's out from Thomas & Mercer on January 24th as an e-book. E-book is, what, $4.99, I'm seeing here? And then you can get the trade.
Yeah, it's coming out in a trade paperback and an e-book and Audible. So
will be in the Barnes & Noble stores, do you think?
They have been, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that's good.
They have been in, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's good to know. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.